So I wondered if there's any questions of clarification. I know we're going to have discussion later, but any clarifying questions for Sahara Moon before we move on to our next session?
Yes.
Thanks. Good. I should have said something. So we have 20 Feed the Future countries, three or four of which are in Central America, and Haiti is one of those. We're not having sort of a major system-focused effort in Latin or Central America. However, we do have research investments there through our university partnerships, the CRISPs, with the International Ag Centers. So there's potential to do sustainable ag research in Haiti. It's certainly an important Feed the Future country. But we're handling those investments a little differently than the ones that we're going to be talking about more today. Yes?
I'd like to clarify, if you're trying to reduce poverty and improve nutrition and so forth, why are you focusing on cereals and not focusing on horticultural crops or high-value vegetables?
So we're focusing on both. I described one of our major thrusts as focusing on climate-resilient cereals, and the rationale behind that is that most farmers will devote at least some of their land to cereal production. That's their staple crop. And if you can increase the production of those staple crops and ensure a more reliable production of those crops, then farmers can, one, they can devote less land to cereals, which allows them to free up other land for nutritious crops like horticulture, legumes, and animal-sourced foods. And it also gives them the ability to make investments in crops which can be riskier if they're not worried about their wheat or their rice is going to come from. So it's really looking at stabilizing production and increasing production. Even though more nutritious foods are necessary, there are also more cereals that are going to be necessary to meet demand. Most of our missions are making investments, as I said, in 3 to 4 select value chains where they're focusing across the entire value chain. And many of our missions have selected horticulture, Nepal, Tanzania, Bangladesh, many, many of them. So it's and what I didn't spend much time was describing the other research investments outside of what we're talking about here today. We do have substantial investments, even from our central research funds, in horticulture, in integrated pest management, in horticultural systems. So that is a part of it. I didn't speak to that very directly. Goodness, yes. Less than half, probably over 40% into breeding and genetics improvement, animal diseases and so forth. Probably a third into, well, not quite a third into, well, if you count, it depends how you count it. but yeah, about a half into breeding and about a half into everything else. It's fair. Yes?
Thanks for a really nice talk. I wonder whether you could just give me some idea of, I mean, we're at a crop science meeting, we're talking about crop science. You alluded to lots of the other considerations, and in my very limited experience in Southern Africa, I mean, I really have a feeling that things like knowledge exchange and extension and looking at cultural issues and social issues and traditional practices, there is a big, big block for extension in many areas. I mean, where are you deliberately focusing on effectively what you've talked about today? I mean, you've alluded to some of these other things. Or, I mean, do you have a comparable program where you look at how some of this information can actually be applied?
I'm not sure I follow. Do we have a comparable program that's not focused on crops?
No. It seems to me you have a very sort of science-focused approach. You're going to generate a lot of new knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How effectively is that knowledge going to be exchanged, taken up, and applied?
Yeah.
Yeah,
across the Feed the Future initiative, there are substantial investments in many of these other areas. We're at a crop science meeting. We're focusing on the science side of things. Our missions are making very substantial investments in extension, in capacity building, on policy issues. So I do think that these science investments are actually very well complemented by a range of other investments that are needed to take it forward.
Thanks for those good questions, and we'll have more time later on this morning for discussion. I do want to come back on Russ's question on diversification. It's a big part of this. And then the last issue, I tend to think about sustainable intensification of how we bring the work we do on research and policies, technologies, and management practices into a context that takes into account all the kinds of diverse issues that you raised. And as Saharmoon said, we do mesh these with a whole range of other investments from at the bilateral level in our focus countries. Okay, our next speaker is Andy McDonald. As Saharmoon said, the international centers of the CGIAR are important partners to us in this undertaking, and Andy comes from one of those. He comes from the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center. He's a cropping systems agronomist. He's based in Kathmandu, Nepal, and he did advise me that if anything goes wrong, we really can blame it on jet lag. It's not just 1 hour away. So, Andy, over to you. Glad to have you with us.
Good morning. Saharmoon actually did set a very high bar for performing with jet lag, so I'll do what I can. So my name is Andy McDonald. I've listed a few other colleagues that are involved in our work through CIMMYT. I'm going to be talking pretty generally about sustainable intensification in South Asian cereal systems. The talk bridges a few different projects, but it's mostly focused on CISA, which USAID Washington, before Feed the Future was inaugurated, gave us support for, along with the Gates Foundation. Okay, so if I can maintain my bearings through all this, I'll give you a little bit of an overview on the South Asian scenario, why we should be interested in South Asia, an introduction to the CISA project, which is funded in part by USAID, examples of innovations for achieving and sustaining high levels of cereal system productivity, and then getting at this issue of going to scale. A lot of what we do in this project in particular is looking at technologies and context and how they move with farmers. It's not just science. It's technologies and context. And then a little bit, one slide anyways, on challenges to success, but may save that for the discussion that we have later in the day. Okay, so this is South Asia, from Pakistan to Bangladesh. And the first graphic on the left there, each red dot represents 50,000 people who are estimated to live under a dollar a day. This is one of despite 10% growth in Bihar and some of the other states in India, South Asia still has tremendous problems with rural poverty. And some of the dynamics with global food prices that catalyzed the initial investments in the program investments in Feed the Future, they're not just a historical artifact. What I've included in the bottom right is a graph of the FAO Food Price Index. And you can see in real terms now the lower series there in yellow were actually higher than we were in 2008. That's in 2011. So this is not ephemeral, right? This is where we end up, God knows, and there will be a lot of bumps along the road. But what happened in 2007, 2008 wasn't a one-off. This is our new reality. Here's a graph that was put together by IFPRI by running the impact model. This is a few years old now, I think from 2008. But these are projected cereal demands to 2050. And the big dog there on the top is East Asia and Pacific, and that's driven a lot by demographic change. But if you look on the third series, that is South Asia. And you can see that there's a pretty steady increase with time. And I should have rescaled this graph, but the essential point is that there'll be double of demand by 2025 for cereals and a potential quadrupling or more by 2050. And this is a substantial challenge. And so I just chose to put up Nepal here to give you a tangible example of where we stand now and where we've gone with this is productivity, but the same thing could be said for aggregate production, because in South Asia, unlike Africa, we're not talking about land conversion. Almost all the land that's suitable for agriculture is already in production. I'm sorry, the one-time series there is a little bit dim. That's wheat. The top one is rice. And what you can see is that the yields for rice have essentially done nothing around a mean for the last decade. About the same thing as for wheat. We've got a bit more penetration of hybrids for maize in the plain area of Nepal, and that's kicked up the maize yields a bit. But still, the bases are very low. I mean, we're talking about anywhere from a ton and a half to less than three for rice. And the growth rates are very low. So there are reasons for this, right? This is not something that we're going to be able to snap our fingers and move beyond. And the pictures that I put in there are meant to be indicative of some of the challenges we face. But we have a lot of old infrastructure that hasn't been maintained. We've got low levels of mechanization. We've got poor penetration of modern best practices, in part because of the knowledge base for it. We've got a feminization of agriculture and a lot of internal and external migration, which has created tremendous labor problems in places like Nepal and places like Bangladesh. And one of my favorite pictures is the one up there on the right. You see a bunch of fertilizer bags stacked on top of a bicycle. And because of some perverse policies that the Nepal government has implemented and an undermining of the market due to subsidized fertilizer in India, we have no legitimate fertilizer market in Nepal. And so there's a steady stream of bicycles that come across the border every winter, bringing the fertilizer supply in. And as you move away from the border, the prices get higher and higher, and the quality gets lower. And you put all these things together, and you realize it's not going to be any one thing that we're going to do that's going to start transforming the kind of yield trends that we currently experience, and we know that we need to. So in general, what we're talking about in South Asia in terms of the challenges to ag development span from land, water, energy, and labor scarcity, increasing cost of production, largely reflective of that labor scarcity, limited access to credit. We have tremendous problems with resource loss and degradation, land, water, and soil, and this whole notion of coping with risks and how we go about that. We have high temperatures, we have droughts, we have inundation in the coastal zones, and more problematic than anything else is the sense that the climate system is becoming less predictable, so we don't know what to plan for. But the key thing to realize in all this is that's the big picture. The little picture is much more complex, and this is really a mosaic of challenges. Some things scale like labor across all of South Asia, but really, there's a lot of geographic differentiation in the major challenges to sustainable intensification. That's Bangladesh, superimposed on the U.S. It's about the size of Iowa. And the map is also Bangladesh, and I've just put in some of the major challenges that we face across the country. This is a small country, but we've got everything from drought and overuse of groundwater and acid soils in the north to dealing with flood cyclones, tidal surges, and salinity in the coastal belt. And, of course, it's not just the biophysical drivers that are different as well. We have very, very big disparities in infrastructure in South Asia. This map is just of India. But as many of you know, the states in the northwest are very, very well advanced. This is a big surface water play that's turned into a groundwater play. And the states of Haryana and Punjab in particular have a very well-supported agriculture. They have a very high rate of irrigation coverage, but they also have a lot of issues with resource degradation and overuse. The states of Punjab and Haryana, the withdrawals for irrigation exceed recharge, and we've got declining water tables. Of course, this has exacerbated issues with electric supply in that part of India. But in the east, the groundwater development with respect to irrigation is barely tapped. Anyway, it's a mosaic. Okay, so CESA. CESA initially was a project that was implemented by with Erie in the lead, with CIMMYT as a co-lead, with IFPRI, which deals with policy, and ILRI. WorldFIST joined, and I'll talk about that in a minute. They joined us in Bangladesh. But this is really a very applied food security project. Right? It started in 2009 with the goal of increasing food, nutrition, and income security in South Asia through sustainable intensification of cereal-based systems, but not exclusively for cereals. We are dealing with some of the high-value things, especially for income generation. Focuses on four countries, Bangladesh, India, Nepal, and Pakistan, and again, supported by USAID Washington and Gates. We're almost done with the phase one of this. Phase two of this project is under review by the donors now. One of the important components of CESA is that it's a big tent initiative. And when I say that, I mean that we're integrating disciplines and institutions. At core of what we're doing is the development and dissemination of sustainable, productive, and economical ag technologies. And that I mean both seed and management. We're talking about breeding, advances in breeding for the development of high-yielding and stress-tolerant cereal varieties. And we have separate objectives for wheat, rice, and maize. We're doing this with a host of partners, and I'll describe that in a little bit more detail in a minute. We're doing this in the context of markets and engagement with the private sector so that we have a clear exit strategy for what we're doing. We're not doing things as project activities as an ends, but as a beginning to catalyze sustained change. And we do have a focus on capacity building through training and scholarship, and we've got policy analysis in addition to some policy advocacy. In addition to the base CESA, as part of Feed the Future, and I hadn't heard that term before, but we're calling them deep dive countries. Bangladesh is a deep dive country. And in the fall of 2010, we got some funds from the mission in Bangladesh with support from our colleagues in Washington to expand CESA in Bangladesh. And we have a five-year plan. It's an enterprise-based diversification. It's broader than just cereals and livestock. We've drawn in World Fish as a core partner to really strengthen what we're doing with diversification and income generation and linking to nutrition. It's very applied in focus. What we're talking about is it doesn't have some of the upstream stuff like the Washington Fund's support on the research side. And we're moving into kind of the stress-prone area of the country, really in the south. And this is very much aligned with the country investment plan. Also, there are other countries that are tapping into Feed the Future support, India, Nepal, and Pakistan, and we're in negotiations now to extend this approach. So, the approach. CESA is based on the concept of the hub. It's really looking at it. It's looking at the local context, knowing that there's no universal template for ag development, that you need strong feedback from communities, that you've got to engage across disciplines, and that you've got to fine-tune things going forward. And at the end of the day, this hub concept really gives us that local or regional basis for the participatory evaluation and refinement of technologies, and hopefully the generation of approaches that really fit local needs and that farmers can sustainably adopt. And the motivating question behind CESA, we all have technologies, we all have insights, we all have perceptions of problems, but we also have a rich history of innovations that haven't moved. And so it's really incumbent on us as a project, as a regional food security initiative, to ask this question. For the things that we've had in our toolkit, why haven't they moved? And again, this goes back to the hub concept of participatory methodologies, of really getting an intimate understanding of farmer circumstances and actively soliciting and engaging with their feedback and using that to adjust priorities moving forward. So in sum, the methodology gets back to some of the things that Sarah Moon had mentioned as well, that the farmers are managing systems, not single commodities. We have to figure out how to optimize systems. That we need geographic differentiation, that there's not going to be one model that we're going to apply across the IGP or anywhere in Asia and expect it to really have positive results. And that we when we're moving to participatory demand-led approaches, we can't forget about the science. We've got to do them at the same time. Neither approach is transformative in isolation. So this, I apologize for the quality of the map, but this gives you an indication of where we have been working and where we will be working when the phase two of this project initiates. But we're all the way from the northwest parts of India and one hub domain in Pakistan to a concentration of areas in Bangladesh to one place in southern India and one place, a proposed hub in Orissa. But this, the central corridor where we're active here, the maps on the right-hand side are the Indo-Gangetic Plain. These are alluvial soils, right? You've got sediments coming down from the Himalaya in the north and coming in from the south from the Deccan Plateau. It's a very fertile area. The rainfalls are comparatively high, and it's really, in addition to being where most of the poor people are located, it's the breadbasket of South Asia. Okay, so that's an overview of kind of the CESA working model. Now I want to give you a very brief flavor of some of the technical innovations that we focus on. And I'm sorry, this is going to be a bit superficial, but due to time constraints, we can pick up some of this stuff during the discussion if need be. Many of the big drivers of change, we have technologies that we know are that orient us in the right direction. That we know that we can have improved water productivity, that we can address issues of labor scarcity, that we can address issues of resource degradation while ensuring yields and increasing profitability. Sarah Moon did a very nice job of describing what conservation agriculture is. That's actually my host program at CIMMYT, is dedicated to conservation agriculture, though we do other things. But I won't go through this exhaustively. The components are reduced soil movement with minimum or zero till, residue retention on the soil surface, and crop rotations that fit those two other practices. But together, what these things do is they result in reduced production costs, which makes it attractive for farmers to adopt in the near term. They increase water use efficiency, and they improve soil quality. But the outcomes associated with this are very important. Resilience to climate risks. Sarah Moon said, and maybe Rob said this too, if you do a better job of managing risks, then farmers are more likely to invest. That resilience to climate risks confers, in many environments, higher, more stable yields and increased profitability. This is one of the platforms we're using to encourage transformations to intensified sustainable production systems. Here's a little bit of data. One of the keys on this is that, yes, CA-based approaches can improve soil quality with time, but you can get very short-term benefits as well. And really, the time horizon, the planning horizon for most farmers is not 10 years. And if we're talking about soil quality in 10 years, we've sort of missed the boat. Nobody's going to pay attention to us. Here's some very short-term data where we've got the conventional practice over on the right with something called the Rotavator, which is very intensive tillage, and a zero till with residue retention on the left. And as you can see, this is wheat. After a single year of conversion to these systems, we had about an 0.8 ton yield increment with the CA-based practice. And at the same time, cost structure went down. Huh? So for wheat, we in these systems, these are in Haryana in India, we had an increase in net profitability of between $100 and $250 per hectare. I should say, to reiterate the point, that if we can couple these near-term gains with long-term sustainability, excuse me, then we really have low barriers to permanent adoption or transitions to more sustainable technologies. It's great to talk about things like CA and think that they're going to move by themselves. We can't do that. You know, there's so many different components that go into making a technology like conservation agriculture work. One of the things that we've worked on in very close collaboration with the, with the private sector are innovations in mechanization. Because simply for a lot of conditions that we have that require good machines, we don't have them. First graphic up there is an example of some of the terrace systems that I deal with in Nepal. We have tremendous out-migration from these areas. Tremendous problems with labor availability. But you can't take a four-wheel, there's no four-wheel tractor to be had. And if you had one, there's no way you could drive it across those terraces. We're working right now, and that red unit on the top is a simple garden-type tiller. These things are extremely lightweight. Two people can pick it up and move it between terraces. And we're innovating a little cedar to put behind it. The example down in the left-hand corner is from the Punjab. The issue there is not availability of equipment, but it's dealing with rice residues. And this is an area where we're not talking about too little residue retention in the system. It's too much. In some cases, we've got 10 tons of residue to deal with. And if you don't want to burn it, which creates tremendous issues with air quality in addition to GHG emissions, you need something like this Turbo Happy Seeder, which is sitting on the right, which actually can reliably seed a crop into that kind of residue load. We're also working on things such as laser land leveling. And this is this goes back to the mid-2000s. A colleague of mine, co-author, actually Raj Gupta, this in gravity-fed irrigation systems, if you have disuniformity in slope, you have a tremendous problem with uniformly distributing water in the field. And that results in poor nitrogen use efficiency, higher pumping costs, lower yields, more variable yields. Laser land leveler gets you away from all that. And what I'm showing here is across the rice wheat system in a gravity-fed irrigation system where you've got more than a ton or around a ton yield increment with laser land leveling. But you also have significant savings in irrigation water, around 20% from what our data suggests, and reduction in pumping costs at the same time. There are also a lot of opportunities for farmers to exploit, and this is also in the Northwest. After rice harvest, they don't feed rice straw, and it's a lean period for fodder supply. And one of the things that we've done is move to a system where you've got dual-purpose wheat, which can be cut, and then grows to provide grain, and mix that with a high-quality legume, and evened out the fodder supply in this area of India, and increased substantially the profitability of farmers who move to this system, going from maybe a net return of on order of $500 to something on order of more than $700. We're not just about technologies. If we're about technologies, we're falling into... I'm blaming the jet lag. It's not just about the technologies. And if we take only a technological focus, we're going to be doing demonstrations until we're blue in the face and nothing's going to change. I'm giving an example here needs-based irrigation. It's also called AWD for rice. You do this by putting a simple pipe into the ground, right? So it's keep moving away from continuously flooding rice. It's saying, here's a simple technology that costs maybe 30 cents to put in, and it gives an objective measure of the water status of the paddy and a guide for when you should irrigate. But in many areas of Bangladesh, most people are renting pump sets. Yeah? And in many areas, they pay for the pump for the entire season. And that includes all costs. That includes access to the pump and fuel. So if you just demonstrate this, there's no incentive for conservation. So we're tackling this from both perspectives. We want to prove that the technology works, but we're also trying to innovate the business models around this so that they're aligned with what the preconditions for making this technology appropriate for this environment. We're also doing things, we have breeding objectives as part of CISA, and we're doing this both on the, we have breeding imperatives around building resilience. We have things like the sub-1 rice, which confers substantial advantage for flooded conditions for rice. It can be completely submerged and still survive for up to 2 weeks. We've got germplasm emerging now that can deal with a lot of the significant stresses that we'd see in an area like southern Bangladesh with respect to salinity. But as importantly, we're also pushing the yield barrier on some of the crops. This is an example of one of the screening trials we had for wheat, that central graphic. And our best line in the trial is 10% higher than the local check, which is substantial. And there's concerns about continued improvements in the yield potential of our elite varieties, and we're making progress. We're also trying to learn from farmers. One of the things that we do is with system intensification, trying to fit more crops in without undermining the prime crop in the system. Farmers in one of our areas in Bangladesh started growing mustard with boro rice because the boro was slow growing, so there's an opportunity early in the season to fit another crop in. Leveraging that innovation, we are doing things on the management side and the germplasm side. And when we do those things together, even though the farmer's practice with this innovation is better than what they were getting before, in some sites we're getting almost $1,000 a hectare more than farmer practice by improving their management. And sometimes when we talk about technical innovation, and we think as scientists, we forget the simple stuff. One of the things that we're trying to do is keep our eye on some of the simple things at the same time. This picture isn't perfect, but if you can see the kind of the lighter areas and the darker areas, this is very typical of many regions of South Asia, where you see poor uniformity of top dressing of nitrogen. This is simple, but this costs farmers probably 10-15% of yield. And so while we're trying to innovate, we're also trying to reinforce bed agronomy. One of the justifications for also putting us all under a big tent is, too, that many of the major areas that we can improve are based on enterprise-based management. It's not maximizing the performance of one component of the system, but it's looking at everything in whole. And I'm just giving an example here of Bangladesh and these areas where we have limited source irrigation water, that if we focus both on the infrastructure and improving that, and then the components as well of increasing the efficiency and the allocation across the system, there's really big gains to be had. And this is really exciting work, and it's really where we have opportunities to increase farmer livelihoods. Okay. Am I done? Rob, what time do?
About 2 minutes.
Okay. At the same time, this fits into the idea that really change with farmers is not one thing, it's many. Right? A lot of times when I talk to my breeder colleagues, they will say that how we're reaching this goal. In this case, I'm defining the goal as access to high-quality adapted seed. And they think that we're going to reach that goal by through breeding. And what I'm trying to demonstrate here is that's only part of the equation. If we handle things only as such, if we think that breeding is going to solve the problem of access to high-quality seed, we've missed the boat. And in CISA, we're trying to put our project planning and our how we stage activities into a common framework where we're looking at, yes, progress with technical themes like breeding, but we're also looking at the public and private seed systems, the dealer networks, the policy incentives and disincentives, and also awareness among farmers. And when you put all that, those things together, when we're talking about accelerating change among farmers, then we have a real opportunity to reach our goals. If we don't do this, we get a lot of ad hoc work where we really are not catalyzing change with farmers. And I'll say in closing, I'm a little bit behind, I apologize, but if we cannot define a change pathway, then we probably shouldn't be doing things as part of a regional food security initiative. That we have to figure out how the pieces fit together and how we're going to mobilize the partnerships to get there. And I have some more slides, but I'll save them for the discussion later on and close with that.